Each time I read through the Bible, I find various things that strike me. I was just thinking yesterday, last night, I don't remember how many years this has been now in a row that I've done the Read the Bible in a Year program, but every year, each year I do, something new pops out at me and gives me reason to meditate a little bit, and I decide, you know, I'm going to do this again. I keep finding things that, I must be getting old, I forget things. That was supposed to be funny. Nobody laughed. Anyway, I decide I'm going to do it again. And I think having a different program where we go through a little bit different schedule with it helps, kind of make it fresh each year. But obviously, it's reading the same text over and over again. Yet I find new things capture my thinking every time I read through the Bible. If you're following that this year, this week, the assigned passages went through the life of Solomon. I found it interesting that Solomon was mentioned in the sermonette, and some of the things I'll say today are, I guess, in some ways going to tie in as well with that. But I've been thinking about Solomon this week. I thought about the fact that God appeared to Solomon in a dream. Not just once, but twice. I mean, wouldn't that be incredible? Wouldn't you love to have God appear to you in a dream and talk with you and say, okay, ask whatever you want? Boy, that would be hard to answer, wouldn't it? Ask whatever you want. And as we know, Solomon asked not for riches, not for long life, not for the death of his enemies, but Solomon asked for wisdom because he realized as king he needed wisdom to guide, to rule God's physical nation of Israel. And God was pleased with that. God was thrilled with his answer and said, well, since you asked for such a good thing and you didn't ask for these other things, I'm going to give them to you anyway. I'm going to give you wealth, going to give you honor. In fact, if you obey me, if you stay true to me, I will give you long life as well. I'll add all of these wonderful blessings if you'll stay faithful to me. About 4 years later, Solomon began building the temple that God wouldn't let his father David build because David was a man of war. He was a bloody man. God said, no, you can't build it, but your son will do it. And a lot of detail is given in the next few chapters about how it took 7 years to build that. 1 Kings 8, I am going to turn to 1 Kings. You can be turning there if you want. In 1 Kings 8, it tells about the pomp and the ceremony and all of the beautiful things that took place at the dedication of the temple. It was an incredible national event. And what was it, a week or two ago that England had this huge pomp and ceremony with the Queen, and it was a huge, huge national event. This was a huge national event in ancient Israel. Then it talks about all the things that took place, and then it tells us Solomon took 13 years to build his own house, almost twice as long as it took to build the temple. Wouldn't you love to have a little glimpse of what his house looked like? If the temple was as incredible as it's described as being, what in the world did his house look like that it took 13 years to build? And when he finished with his own house, God appeared to him again in a dream, chapter 9. You'll turn there. Notice it says, it came to pass when Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house, that all Solomon's desire, and all Solomon's desire which he wanted to do, that the Lord appeared to Solomon the second time, as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. Now, as I said, I think most of us would be thrilled to have God appear to us just once in our lifetime. But here, God appeared to him a second time in a dream. And he put his stamp of approval on the house, the temple, with all its beauty, with all of its elegance that Solomon had built for him. He said, it's good. This is wonderful. I approve of it. Verse 3, and the Lord said to him, I've heard your prayer. This was a prayer of dedication several years, 13 years prior to this, apparently, that when the dedication took place. I've heard your prayer and your supplication, which you've made before me. I have consecrated this house, which you've built, to put your name there forever, to put my name there, rather, forever. And my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. Now, if you walk before me as your father David walked, in integrity of heart, and in uprightness to do according to all that I have commanded you. And if you keep my statutes and my judgments, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever. As I promised David your father, saying, you shall not fail to have a son on the throne of Israel. Notice it's a conditional clause. If, programmers know what that means in computer programming, if there's a branch that's going to happen. If one thing, do this. If something else, do something different. God is saying, if you will obey me, if you will stick with me, if you will worship me only, wonderful things are going to happen. Tremendous blessings are going to come to you. I'll establish your throne forever, like I promised your father. But notice the verse 6, but, that's such a big word, isn't it? Such an important word. If you do this, that will happen. However, there is another option in this if clause. But if you or your sons at all turn from following me and do not keep my commandments and my statutes which I've set before you, but go and serve other gods and worship them, then I will cut off Israel from the land that I have given them. And this house which I have consecrated for my name, I will cast out of my sight. Israel will be a proverb and a byword among all peoples. And as for this house which is exalted, everyone who passes by it will be astonished and will hiss and say, oh, man, why has the Lord done this to this land and to this house? And they will answer, because they forsook the Lord their God, who brought their fathers out of the land of Egypt, having embraced other gods and worshiped them and served them. Therefore, the Lord has brought all this calamity on them. Now, it happened at the end of the 20 years when Solomon had built the two houses, the house of the Lord and the king's house, that Hiram had supplied cedar and so forth. And it goes on. So here we are, maybe 24 years into Solomon's reign. 20 years building houses. He started them in the fourth year of his reign. So probably 24 years into his reign. And God appeared to him again. And he repeats what he said the first time. If you will be wholehearted, I will bless you. If you will serve me and obey me, I will bless you. The rest of chapter 9 and all of chapter 10 describes Solomon's great wealth and his wisdom, describes his trading, describes all the things that he did, chariots and horses at the end of chapter 10. I want to pick it up with chapter 11, verse 1, because chapter 11 again begins with that ominous word, describing all of the wealth and all of his trading and all of the wonderful things that Solomon was doing. Verse 1 of chapter 11 says, but King Solomon loved many foreign women as well as the daughter of Pharaoh. Women of the Moabites, Amorites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites, from the nations of whom the Lord had said to the children of Israel, you shall not intermarry with them, nor they with you. Surely they will turn away your hearts after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love. He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines. And his wives turned away his heart. 1,000 women. Just mind-boggling that Solomon would have this kind of family. But it says they turned away his heart. And it was so, when Solomon was old, that his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not loyal to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. For Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and after Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. Solomon did evil in the sight of the Lord and did not fully follow the Lord, as did his father David. And it goes on to describe the high places and the different things that he did in worshiping, in burning incense to these gods, in sacrificing to these other gods. He turned away from worshiping God. Down in verse 13, therefore the Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this, you've not kept my covenant and my statutes, which I commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom away from you and give it to your servant. Nevertheless, I'll not do it in your days for the sake of your father David. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away the whole kingdom. I'll give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. You know, when you analyze this, and this has been on my mind this week after reading through this, the wisest man in the world had a very clear choice before him. Worship me only, serve me only, do it wholeheartedly, obey me, follow my instructions, and I will bless you beyond your wildest dreams. Turn away from me, and you're going to suffer a lot of consequences. And the wisest man in the world, we're told, about Solomon, couldn't make the right choice. Couldn't stick with the right choice. Apparently he started out the right way, but he turned out to be pretty foolish in terms of his relationship with God. I'd like to explore that amazing anomaly a little bit today. How could someone so smart be so dumb? I mean, when you analyze that, how could he have such wisdom, such insight into so many aspects of life, and yet not get it in his relationship with God? Now, I might propose one thought to you, that Solomon had a problem with relationships. You can explore that however you wish to, but 1,000 women, I think he had a problem with relationships and understanding what a good relationship really was. And he certainly didn't understand a good relationship with God. Didn't understand what that was all about. But you wonder, how could someone so smart not get it? God had personally appeared to Solomon. I mean, not just somebody coming to him and saying, "Hey, Solomon, God told me, or I think this is what God wants you to do." This was God in a dream saying, "Solomon, here's the deal. Here are the options. You pick, you choose." It's about choice. He had choice. God personally warned him not to turn aside, to do what seemed good in his own mind, what seemed to be the right thing to do. "Well, all these wives, they want me to do this, and I love them, I want to have some kind of a relationship with them, so I'll go worship this particular God or that particular God." What seemed good in his own mind, to honor and worship the gods of his many wives. It's incredible. Those options, serve me and obey me, have a long prosperous life of honor and riches, and your dynasty will live on. But if you turn away from me, you or your sons, to worship other gods, I'll cut you off, I'll disown you, I'll disown this magnificent temple you've built, and I'll leave you. Surely Solomon was smart enough, wise enough, he could figure out the principles of cause and effect, right? I mean, that's what an if statement is. It's really cause and effect. If you do this, this will happen. If you do that, something else is going to happen. Cause and effect. It seems so simple, and yet Solomon couldn't seem to grasp it with all his wisdom. Somehow, he had to have convinced himself, God says this, but there's another way. There's got to be a better way. I don't have to follow what God says. Somehow, he had to convince himself that God didn't really mean it, or that the blessings would come anyway, even if he didn't do what he was supposed to do. Do you and I ever do that? We ever do that in our relationship with God and say, "Well, it's I can disobey and I can expect a response other than what God says." Let me put it in a gardening analogy. Got a good garden this year. Love it. Great blessing. Thankful for it. Last year was a bust. Nothing. But who would plant beans and convince themselves that tomatoes were going to grow on those bean plants? Sounds stupid, doesn't it? I hear you chuckling. It sounds ridiculous. When I plant bean plants, I expect beans to grow on those plants. I don't expect tomatoes. I don't expect potatoes. I don't expect squash or anything else. I expect beans. When I plant tomatoes, I expect tomatoes. God said, "Do this, and this is the fruit that will come from this." You're sowing seed. You're planting something, and this is the fruit. You plant something else, you're going to get different fruit. It's cause and effect. It just seems so simple. And yet, sometimes we plant and expect a different crop to grow, which is amazing. Really amazing. I want to begin exploring this topic by looking at a proverb, and I'd like to turn to Proverbs chapter 26. As I said, this thought was, in looking at Solomon, it just struck me how much he failed to grasp what we would consider a very simple concept. Now, I realize it can get rather complicated, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. In fact, I was reading a doctoral presentation yesterday online about causality, and you can get really wrapped up in a lot of deep issues in terms of cause and effect. But there are a lot of simple statements that God makes that are cause and effect. Proverbs chapter 26 and verse 2 says, like a flitting sparrow, like a flying swallow, so a curse without cause shall not alight. You know, birds flying around, they're not going to land, he said, that they're not going to land just by, unless there's the curse without a cause, it's not going to light. It's not going to land on you unless there is a reason for it. Now, a curse is not just blind chance. A curse is something that is the result of what we've done or not done. The book of Ecclesiastes tells us time and chance happened all. We'll come back to that. Sometimes things are just random, whether it's good or whether it's disaster. Sometimes they are random. That's what makes this topic quite interesting to think about. Sometimes there are random issues, random events that take place. But in the sense of what he's describing here in Proverbs 26:2, a curse without cause is not going to come. If it is a curse, it denotes a cause behind it. There's a reason for that landing. It's a reason for that coming to you, coming to roost. It's a matter of cause and effect. I also read this week about Solomon's son, Rehoboam. And if you'll remember the story, if you didn't read it this week, you'll probably remember it from reading it in past years, that when Rehoboam came to the throne, the people of Israel came to him and said, you know, Solomon really put a burden on us. It was hard to try to live up to all of the things that he demanded of us. Would you lighten the load a little bit? To put it in today's terms, you know, taxes are 90% of what we're taking home. Can you lighten the tax load a little bit? Can you give us a little bit of a break? And Rehoboam listened to the advice of the older, wiser men, and he didn't take their advice, because their advice was, well, yeah, lighten it up a little bit. And if you do, they'll serve you. They'll appreciate, they'll love you for it. The younger men who had grown up with, his young counselors, said, hey, tell them your dad was nothing compared to what you're like. You're going to make it even harder on them. There's something intuitively wrong with that approach, isn't there? I mean, in my mind, there's something intuitively wrong with it. Say, I'm going to be worse than my dad. It's already hard. I'm going to make it harder on you. Israel rebelled, set up Jeroboam as their king, and God's word came true, that because Solomon had turned away to serve other gods, had turned away his trust, his obedience to God, and went and served other gods, that God took away Israel. It was torn from the hand of his son. It was given to Jeroboam. I'd like to look at the insight we're given in Proverbs chapter 14 about this principle, cause and effect. Proverbs chapter 14 and verse 8. It says, the wisdom of the prudent is to understand his way, but the folly of fools is deceit. As is typical with the Proverbs, in many places there is a verse that has two opposites. It has a statement and it has its antithesis. It has a statement of one on one side of things and it has a statement on the other. Verse 8 begins with the statement of the wise person. The wisdom of the prudent is to understand his way. A prudent person, a wise person, wants to analyze his life. He wants to analyze what he's doing. He wants to understand what he's doing. And he wants to understand the cause and effect in his life. He wants to get a clear look at things, to see things as they really are. And I realize that's a challenge to all of us, to see things the way they really are. You've probably heard the statement before that there are many sides to any issue. There are many views of any particular event. And seeing them clearly, really understanding them, it's often hard to do, to see it clearly, to not blame others, to not try to look at others as the reason for certain things happening in your life, but to look at your own life, look at your own actions, look at what you are experiencing and seeing if there's a connection. As I said, not always is it a direct cause. Sometimes there is time and chance. Again, we'll come back to that. But it is wisdom. It is wise for a prudent individual to be looking to see if this is time and chance, or is there a reason for this? On the other hand, fools get involved in folly. They do foolish things and they're deceived about it. So their folly is deceit. Now what does that mean? Well, it just means that they deceive themselves. They think, well, there's nothing wrong with what I'm doing. And calamity comes because of their actions, because cause and effect is taking place. They don't understand it. They're baffled by it. And they don't have a clue as to why they're going through what they're going through. Something isn't right. It's not the way it's supposed to be. But they're not able to analyze. They don't connect the dots of the cause and effect. Notice what God said to ancient Israel, Deuteronomy chapter 28. Let's go there. Deuteronomy chapter 28. The first four verses, God says, as they were getting near the promised land, he said, "Now it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commands which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all nations of the earth. And all these blessings will come upon you and overtake you, because you obey the voice of the Lord your God." I like the way that's phrased. They'll come on you. They'll just overtake you. You'll just be sort of, they'll sweep over you. It's like, I think of standing in an ocean with waves. You know, they just kind of sweep over you. The surf comes up and just washes over you. It's just a natural process. All these blessings will come upon you and overtake you because you obey the voice of the Lord your God. There's the cause and effect. Blessed shall you be in the city. Blessed shall you be in the country. Blessed shall be the fruit of your body, the produce of your ground, and the increase of your herds, and the increase of your cattle, and the offspring of your flocks. God said, I'm going to bless you so many different ways you can't count them. If you'll obey me, if you'll stick with me, these blessings are just going to overtake you. They're going to well up and flow over you. That's just a natural response. Blessings are a natural result of obeying God, of being devoted to him, of not letting that devotion split. But there is the other side of the coin. Just as in any if statement, there is the other side. In verse 15, he comes back to that. He says, "But it shall come to pass, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments and all his statutes, which I command you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you." Same thing. They'll just overwhelm you. They're going to overtake you. "Cursed shall you be in the city. Cursed shall you be in the country. Cursed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. Cursed shall be the fruit of your body and the produce of your land and the increase of your cattle and the offspring of your flocks," and on and on and on it goes. Just like blessings naturally flow from obedience, when we don't obey God, he said there are some natural causes that also come. Curses come from disobedience. And I keep thinking of Solomon. He never figured that out. Or at least it doesn't seem he did. As was mentioned in the sermonette, he had to understand about repentance, and yet there's no evidence that he ever practiced it in his life. That he never put it into practice. Solomon never figured out that worshiping the gods of all his wives was the reason he had all these little pesky adversaries on the edge of his kingdom. If you read the passages in 1 Kings 11, it talks about Hadad, the Edomite, and Rezon, who had a band of raiders, and they were constant thorns in Solomon's side. And he never put it together. Now, could that have been a random chance, time and chance? Perhaps. But God tells us he raised up these adversaries for Solomon. Why would God do that? Well, he did it because he loved Solomon. He did it because he wanted Solomon to think about what was happening, and he wanted Solomon to be able to connect the dots. I'm not doing what's right. That's why I'm having such and such. That's why this city is being overtaken. That's why that city is being raided. He never put that together. Never connected the dots. Yet God very clearly and personally had warned him twice that he needed to stay true and submissive only to God. How could it be that such a wise man could be so blind? Probably a number of you have already thought of Jeremiah 17. We'll go ahead and turn there. In many ways, this is a very basic message, and yet one that from time to time I think we all need to think about. I need to think about. You need to think about. All of us need to think about. Jeremiah 17:9 tells us this about us as humanity in general. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? I, the Lord, search the heart. I test the mind, even to give every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his doings. The heart, those innermost feelings, the mind, the thinking process that we go through. God tells us is very deceptive. Incredibly deceptive. My margin has the words, instead of desperately wicked, it has the words incurably sick. That's what God inspired Jeremiah to say about us. We don't always think rationally as human beings in terms of our relationship with God. God says he will ensure that we sow, or reap, I should say, the crop that we sow. He'll see that we reap that. If we sow wild oats, that's the crop we're going to reap. If we sow righteousness, obedience to God, and peace, we'll reap that crop. That's what God is saying in these types of passages. Look at verse 11. That's kind of the follow-on to this thought that our minds can deceive us very easily. Verse 11 is a partridge that broods but does not hatch. So he who gets riches but not by right, it will leave him in the midst of his days. And at the end of his end, he will be a fool. God says, I'll make sure you reap what you sow. Now the one kicker in this, or one of the kickers in this, is a little issue called time, isn't it? Time. When is the end of a person? When will my end be? When will your end be? We don't know, do we? And yet God says, in the end, at his end, he will be a fool. When we read biblical accounts, we have the benefit of reading a condensed version. I thought of that several times too, reading the life of Solomon. Here we are in 1 Kings. We have 11 chapters that are devoted to his life, and it was, what, 40 years, roughly 40 years that he reigned? 40 years are condensed into 11 very short chapters. And we have the benefit of compression of time. We see the beginning of his life. We see halfway through, 24 years into it, when God appeared to him again, halfway through his rule, 24 years, may as well say halfway. We round it. Maybe you'll give me a year. Be generous. Roughly halfway through. And he still didn't get the message. But we have the compression of time. We get to see the beginning. We get to see the end. I'm not sure the change in Solomon from trusting and obeying God to worshiping other gods was instant. In fact, I'm pretty sure it wasn't. I'm pretty sure it was a very gradual process. I would imagine, and again, I'm speculating on this, and I'll openly say that I'm speculating because I'm not told. But I would imagine the first time Solomon went to one of those other idols, one of those other gods, and he burned incense to that god, that supposed god of one of his wives, he probably had some pangs of conscience. Oh, you know, God said I shouldn't do this. Oh, man. I better not do that again. And then another wife comes and says, hey, you did that for wife X. You know, I'm wife 796. Why don't you do it to my God? You know, you must not love me. You love her more than, well, no, we're not going there. Anyway, the next time he did it for another god, he probably had another little pang. But how long was it before it's, well, you know, nothing happened. I didn't get struck dead with lightning. Maybe God didn't really mean it after all. Maybe God, you know, the blessings are still there. I'm still king, still wealthy, still got all this honor. I still have my wisdom. I can still discern, you know, what things are going on. That process, I personally believe, took a lot of time. But eventually, Solomon must have ignored those pangs of guilt and conscience and ended up worshiping other gods. Yeah, and that's the thing about time. That's the issue with time. Some people look like they're beating the odds. Again, I'll use the common phrase, sowing the wild oats and reaping a crop of success and joy. Let's use a far-out example, drug dealers. I mean, we don't have any drug dealers here. Pretty confident of that. So I can use them, and nobody thinks, oh, he's talking about me. You know, oh, the guys up there standing are talking about me today. No, I'm not talking about anybody in particular. I'm talking about all of us. So let's use drug dealers. Drug dealers have lots of money, don't they? I mean, they drive around from what I understand about drug dealers. Not that I'm... Okay. They drive around in expensive cars. They've got guns, you know, galore. Any kind you can think of, outgun the police like crazy, and they got money rolling out their ears. They look like they're a success. Are they really successful? Is their life at the end, as we read, is their life going to be a success? No. Many of them die pretty ignominious deaths. In the end, they end up being a fool for the choices that they've made. See, that's the thing, again, about time. Sometimes, in the middle, it may look like people are beating the odds. But God says if our actions are not right, in the end, we'll be left a fool. Exactly when is the end? Don't know. Don't know. The ultimate end, of course, the Bible talks about that. Revelation 20 talks about a lake of fire and so forth, and I'm not really going there. This isn't a fear-based sermon. Oh, yeah, you're going to go. No, that's not what I'm into. We ought to obey God because we love Him, because we want that relationship with Him, not because we fear a negative outcome. But there is cause and effect, and that's the part I wanted to focus on today. A wise person realizes self-deception is so easy. It's so natural to us as human beings. It's so natural for us to do that. There's a book. It kind of intrigued me several years back. Actually, it was the title that caught my eye. The book was entitled The Lies We Believe. It was written by a Christian psychologist. Dr. Chris Thurman was his name. And I felt the book had some good points. Didn't necessarily agree with all of them. But one of the points that it talked about was self-deception, that we have things that we are convinced about that are not true. We're convinced that they are. Seems true to us, but they're not. I have to be concerned about not deceiving myself. And of course, you have to be concerned about not deceiving yourself. All of us have to be concerned about that individually. Once we've convinced ourselves of something, we see that as being reality. Solomon, somewhere, somehow along the line, saw it as reality that he was going to be blessed even if he worshipped other gods. That all these good things that he was experiencing were just going to continue. But that wasn't the case, was it? Was not true, even though he thought it was true. If I'm convinced of something that's not right, I hope God will knock me upside the head or somehow get my attention for me to realize, hey, what you're thinking is not true. I hope I will have the humility to be able to ask God to help me see things clearly. And if I'm not seeing them clearly, help me get my vision straightened out. Help me see your vision of truth, Father, not mine. I said we come back to that question of whether something bad happening is a time and chance or if it's a curse. Let's go to Ecclesiastes chapter 9. I've alluded to this, but in the book of Ecclesiastes, is where we find that statement. Again, Solomon seems to be the author of this book, the book of Ecclesiastes, and in chapter 9, verse 10 is a passage many of us have memorized, to do whatever you do with your might, really give it your all. Verse 11, he says, I returned, Ecclesiastes 9:11, I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill. But time and chance happen to just a few people. Not what he said, is it? Time and chance happen to all. It is true, you can be in the wrong place at the wrong time and somebody runs into you. I guess it was about a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, Kathy and I were driving here through downtown Tyler, and a truck just pulled out right in front of us. I tested the Prius's brakes and they work. Thankfully, everything in the car was on the floorboards in the back seat. And actually, it will burn rubber stopping. I thought with the anti-lock brakes that maybe it wouldn't do that, but it skidded. And it barely got by before we collided. Time and chance. If I had not been paying strict attention to where I was, and I even looked at her as she started to turn, I thought, no, she's not going to turn. Yes, she is! Slam the brake. Time and chance happens to all of us. Some bad things are simply time and chance. Now, the other side of that is, it could be something that we need to think about. Personal confession made me think about making sure I watch the road. Be a little more alert in watching cars. I try to do that anyway. Watch the cars around me. Watch the cars that are coming from one side or the other. Could be just simply chance. Or it could be God allowing something to happen to us. Why? Because he wants to see our reaction. He wants to see how we handle it. Or he wants to see how other people respond to that particular circumstance. I mean, there could be all kinds of reasons God may allow something to happen. Remember what happened to Job? Satan came to God, and God is the one who pointed out Job and said, have you considered him? I mean, this is a righteous man. This is a guy who is blameless and upright. He eschews, he hates evil. He runs from evil. He doesn't want anything to do with it. Turn with me to Job chapter 1. Satan's response is interesting and one that I think we should never forget. We should remember this statement always. Job chapter 1 and verse 9. Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him? Around his household and around all that he has on every side, you've blessed the work of his hands and his possessions have increased in the land. Cause and effect. Job has obeyed you. And you have blessed him. But you know what, God? You've also protected him. You've set a hedge around all that stuff. And I can't get in there to do anything to him. Should give us reason to pause and think, how much does God do to help us? You've protected him. Verse 11, but now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he'll surely curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power, only do not lay a hand on his person. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Satan acknowledged God's protection of Job. God, you've put a hedge about him. Yeah, things are going well for him because you're doing that. You're protecting him. You're helping him. You're blessing him. And the only reason all the calamity that we read about in the book of Job, and I'm not going to go through the book of Job, the only reason all of that calamity came was because Satan challenged God to remove that protection. And if you do, he's going to turn around and curse you. Thankfully, Job was a stronger faith than that, and he didn't do it. Yet three of the four friends of Job who came to comfort him were convinced the problems were a direct curse from God. Go to chapter 4. We'll just read a couple of verses there and then pop to the end of the book. Job chapter 4 and verse 7. This is Eliphaz, who is writing, who is speaking to Job. First they came and looked at him, sat for a whole week. They were so amazed at how horrible Job looked. Nobody said anything for a week, and finally they began talking. Here's what Eliphaz says. I'm going to pick it up in verse 7. Remember now, whoever perished being innocent. Cause and effect, Job. Cause and effect. Whoever perished being innocent, or where were the upright ever cut off? Even as I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. By the blast of God they perish, and all the breath of his anger, and by the breath of his anger, they're consumed. I've seen it happen, Job. Those who do bad things end up being punished for it. Cause and effect. Job, you must have done something horrible. This must be terrible what you're involved in, that God is punishing you this way. And yet we're told, again, we have the benefit of time compressed in the book, we realize that wasn't what was taking place. That God just simply removed the protection for a little bit to see what Job would do. Job's friends were convinced there was some sin that Job was being punished for. But God had declared he was blameless. He told Satan, he's blameless. And the end of the book, we see that Job came to a much better perspective of himself in comparison to God. Job chapter 42. Job benefited. Job learned from this. Was it hard to go through that terrible trial? Yes, it was. And I'm not for a minute going to pretend it wasn't. To lose your whole family, all your possessions, everything, all at once, in one day? Wow. Talk about overwhelming problems. And then to be struck physically the way he was. It's a horrible thing to go through. In verse 1 of chapter 42, then Job answered the Lord and said, and we'll skip down to verse 5, he said, I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes. I learned a lot from this, Job says. Job learned a lot. Great lesson from that test. And the last chapter of the book says God blessed him in the end more than ever. Now the point is, we don't always know whether something is a curse, or whether it's time and chance, or whether it's God simply removing his hand to allow something to happen and see how we respond to it. Will we turn and curse God, as Job was advised to do? Or will we remain faithful to God? Now again, at times we may not even know whether it's our problems or whether it is time and chance. But we're told over and over again that we don't need to look at other people. When something like that happens, our responsibility is to be concerned about our own spiritual life. Matthew chapter 7. Jesus Christ made a statement in the Sermon on the Mount that's pretty well known. Matthew chapter 7. We don't need to be trying to figure out if somebody else's calamity is cause and effect, time and chance, whether it's God removing his protection to see what they will do when something bad is allowed to happen. The point is, we need to be focused on our own lives. We need to be focused on our growth. Chapter 7, verse 3, why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own eye? Those of you who remember Basil Wolverton's drawings with this huge guy with his huge, I guess it was a 4x4 or a 6x6, whatever, hanging out of his eye as he was walking around trying to get a speck out of this other guy's eye. Humorous way of depicting it. But why do you try to get that speck out of your brother's eye? Don't consider the plank in your own. How can you say to your brother, let me remove the speck from your eye, and look, a plank is in your own eye? Hypocrite, first remove the plank from your own eye. Then you can see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. We're to examine our own lives. We're to look at how we're doing in our relationship with God. Are we building that relationship? Is it being nurtured? Are we maintaining that relationship and building it? So, is it curse? Is it a chance? Is it simply God allowing a test? It's not for us to say in terms of other people. we need to be analyzing our own situations and looking to ourselves and looking to our own life when difficult times come. Most of all, we need to make sure we trust God and stay faithful to Him. So if the human mind is so deceptive, how does a person know if they're having trouble getting a clear look at cause and effect in their life? Probably a number of indicators. I'll just mention a couple of them here. I believe there are some that we can talk about. And the first one I'll mention is blaming others. That's the oldest trick in Satan's book, and it works. That's why it's the oldest one, because it worked from the beginning, and it still works. You remember the story in the Garden of Eden. I won't spend a lot of time there, but I will turn to chapter 3. We'll read just a few verses. It's so easy when we are literally reaping the crop that we have sowed to look and blame someone else for the crop we're reaping. Chapter 3, when God came to Adam and Eve after they had eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil that He commanded them not to eat of, and said, when you do, that day will seal your fate that you are going to die. They ate of the tree, verse 9 of chapter 3. The Lord called Adam and said, where are you? And he said, well, I heard your voice in the garden. I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself. And God's response was, who told you you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree of which I commanded you that you should not eat? And instead of giving a factual response to the direct question, notice the deflection that Adam was involved in. It wasn't a direct, you asked me a yes-no question. My answer is, yes, unfortunately, I did eat of that tree. Instead, he deflected. He wanted to blame Eve. Well, you know, that woman you gave me to be with me, she gave me of the tree and I ate. It's her fault, God. Actually, it's your fault, God, because you gave her to me. So easy to deflect and not take responsibility ourselves, to blame others. He went to the woman, said, what is this you've done? The woman said, the serpent deceived me and I ate. It's common to mankind. Men and women, we all tend to want to do that. We want to blame others. We want to deflect. Eve blamed the serpent. God didn't even give the father of lies a chance to shift the blame. He just directly said, okay, serpent, you're cursed. Here's what's going to happen. And Adam and Eve, here's what's going to happen to you as well. The difficulties they were going to suffer as a result of their choice. So blaming others is very, very natural, very easy to do. But it's an indication that we're not looking clearly. When we find ourselves looking for blame, looking to blame others, that's an indication that we may not be looking openly, honestly, humbly, asking God for help and seeing clearly. Another common indicator is, let's turn to Proverbs chapter 22. Another common one is anger. It's an indication that someone's not really looking clearly. If I find myself getting really angry over something that's happened, I always want to stop and ask why. What's the real issue? What's really going on with this? I read many years ago that anger is a secondary emotion. It's not a primary. It's a result of other issues. But it's a very powerful emotion. Proverbs 22 and verse 8 says this, he who sows iniquity will reap sorrow. Here's again this sowing and reaping, this cause and effect. And the rod of his anger will fail. There's a connection here with anger. The cause and effect playing out in someone's life, and they use anger to try to negate the effect. They try to negate the result and the bad crop that they're reaping is not going to be negated. Anger is an attempt to negate that. It's an attempt to wield power over others. There are a lot of things we could say about anger. I've noted in recent years that it's sort of the favored motivator among all kinds of groups. Today, everybody wants to be angry about something or another. And it's used as a motivator for all kinds of causes. And the problem is that anger often backfires. If you use it to control others, before long, they're going to try to use it to control you. It backfires. It just doesn't work. Either way, you end up with nothing. It backfires and fails. And those who choose to live a life of iniquity and end up in vanity and nothingness get that result. That's all they end up with. They end up with nothing. There are lots of places that there's natural consequences. Cause and effect are very prominent. Go to a couple of others before we close. I'd like to turn to Proverbs chapter 11. Here we see cause and effect is a big part of relationships. Proverbs chapter 11 and verse 29, he who troubles his own house will inherit the wind, and the fool will be servant to the wise of heart. I'm going to focus on that first part. Doesn't use the word sowing, doesn't talk about planting bad seed, doesn't talk literally about reaping a crop, but it does talk about the end result because it talks about inheriting. In the end, this is what you will receive. This is what you will inherit. If you sow trouble in your household, if you sow trouble in your family, there will be negative consequences in your family relationships. You will inherit them. It will become a part of your life. Relationships are a big topic, huge topic. Some families have situations where parents or children won't talk to each other, haven't seen each other for decades. I hear of that from time to time, and it saddens me to hear that. Every time I hear of those kinds of issues within families, one sibling won't talk to his brother or sisters, won't have anything to do with them. I think how sad that interpersonal strain on those relationships has gotten to that point. Now, obviously, there's something that has caused that. There's a cause for that, usually. Someone has usually done something that hurts the other, and usually pretty badly. And they've not done anything to make it right, so it festers and it doesn't get resolved, which, again, is sad. Again, don't think you can sow words or deeds of anger and emotional warfare and expect to harvest a crop of peace. It just doesn't work that way. It's not what we'll reap. James adds a thought to that, James chapter 3, in terms of peace. And this could be of any type of peace. I'm focusing primarily now on relationships, but James chapter 3 and verse 18 says, now the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. I'll read that to you from another translation. Simple English says, and the fruit of righteousness grows peacefully within the people who make peace. There is a sowing. There is a making of peace, doing what you can to make peace. Again, you can't force the other person to make peace with you, but if you at least do your part, there's a chance that there can be a crop of peace that is reaped from that. Verses in contrast to one, a couple of verses earlier in verse 16 where it says, where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. Envy, selfishness, when those are involved, they usually produce fruit, and the fruit is not good. It's disorderly. It's full of confusion. It's full of all kinds of evil. So again, if you want peace, you have to sow peace. Now, the how of doing that with interpersonal relationships, no, we don't have time for that. That's a huge topic, isn't it? Big, big topic. But I felt it was something we should at least mention when we're looking at cause and effect. Now, before I close, I do want to remind you, the laws of cause and effect work both ways. I started out by talking about Solomon, the wisest man in the world, and yet he couldn't seem to grasp the law of cause and effect. He ended up reaping bad things because he didn't choose to do right. But if you choose to do right, God blesses you with good things. And that's what he wants to do. That's his goal. That's his desire. Turn with me to Deuteronomy chapter 30. Even going back to ancient Israel, that was his desire with them. We know their history. We know they didn't follow through. We know they did turn away from God. We know Solomon turned away from God. But God's desire, what he wants, is to give good things. He wants us to sow good crops so we can reap bountiful blessings from Him. Reap bountifully of good things. Deuteronomy chapter 30, as they, again, Deuteronomy was written as they neared the promised land. In verse 15, God says, "See, I've set before you today life and good, death and evil. In that I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in His ways, and to keep His commandments, His statutes, and His judgments, that you may live and multiply. And the Lord your God will bless you in the land which you go to possess." That's what God leads with. I want to bless you. I want your harvest to be harvests of good things. Wonderful blessings. God describes Himself as merciful, loving, anxious to bless. He's not ambivalent about our choices. He says, "I want you to choose what's good. Make the right choices so I can bless you." Verse 17, "But if your heart turns away, so that you do not hear and are drawn away and worship other gods and serve them, I announce to you today that you'll surely perish and you'll not prolong your days in the land that you cross over the Jordan to go in and possess." There's the warning. Yes, it does work both ways. I want to bless you, so make good choices. That'll cause good things to come to you. The effect will be good. If you don't, the effect will not be good. He comes back to the positive again before the chapter ends. Verse 19, "I call heaven and earth as witness today against you that I've set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life that both you and your descendants may live, that you may love the Lord your God, that you may obey His voice, you may cling to Him, for He is your life and the length of your days, and that you may dwell in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give them." God is pulling for us. He's pulling for you. He's pulling for me. He wants every one of us to have good crops. He wants us to reap the benefits. He desperately wants to bless us if we'll just sow the right seeds by obeying Him. Do what's right, and God is more than happy to bless us, more than happy to give us good crops. There'll be some bumps in the road. Yes, there'll be some tough spots. Our attitude will be tested. Our trust in God will be tested. We know that from reading the New Testament. It's just a part of the Christian life. But as long as we stay faithful to God, He wants to give us ultimately everything. We need to make sure we don't make the mistake of Solomon and so many other kings of Israel did. We need to remember the law of cause and effect. Because whatever we sow, that crop is going to grow. Galatians chapter 6, we'll end with this passage. In Galatians. Galatians chapter 6. First of all, in verse 7, it says, "Do not be deceived. God isn't mocked, for whatever a man sows, that he will also reap." To use the analogy again, I cannot plant green beans and expect to harvest tomatoes. Won't happen, and it doesn't happen in life that way either in our relationship with God. What we sow, we're going to reap. "For he who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption. But he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life." And verse 9 is the encouragement to not get tired of doing the right thing. Do the right thing and you will reap. Maybe not instantly. You'll have some bumps along the way, but eventually you will reap everlasting life. Verse 9 says, "Let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we will reap if we do not lose heart." Don't reap eternal life instantly, but ultimately we do if we'll learn the law of cause and effect and if we will plant good crops.